Hi, everybody. I'm Marla Cohn. Can you hear me back there? I'm Marla Cohn from Environmental Health News. Welcome to our panel on reproductive health and the environment. This panel started when somebody from SEJ called me and said, we're thinking of having a panel on reproductive health. Would you like to do it? And I said, sure, sounds like a great topic. And I asked, I said, are you interested in women's health only or in men's reproductive health too? And he said, well, are there men's reproductive health issues? And I said, well, you know, there's the sperm and then there's this egg, and they sort of have to get together. And so I felt like I was sort of, you know, that. But the short answer is yes, there's men's reproductive health issues related to the environment too. I want to tell you guys a story of, start with a story of a drug called by the name of DES. It was first manufactured in 1938, and it was prescribed to women who there was fear of miscarriages from the late 1940s and all the way until 1971. And it was a very powerful synthetic estrogen, and 5 to 10 million women and their offspring were exposed. Now, estrogen, we know, is a good thing for women, but in this case, it was too much of a good thing, especially for their babies. And too much estrogen can alter reproductive development. Well, what happened was a generation was created of DES sons and DES daughters, baby boomers, people who are now 40 and over. And among the girls, some of the girls wound up infertile with a rare vaginal cancer with uterus malformations. The sons had some testicular problems, some fertility issues. And this told everybody at the time of a very important lesson with DES, that fetal exposure to excess hormones can alter your reproductive tract and affect your fertility years, decades later in adulthood. And it's also believed now that those DES granddaughters and grandsons might be having effects too. So you're talking multiple generations. So, well, most people sort of forgot about that whole DES story, except, of course, the victims of the offspring of the women who took that drug. And that was, but until the late 1980s, when, believe it or not, alligators in Florida were turning up half male, half female. And you could say, okay, what's the association between a drug that was used for pregnant women and alligators in Florida? Well, it turned out that these alligators were exposed to a pesticide that acted like a hormone. It actually blocked an androgen, male hormones. This was in Lake Apopka, Florida. Scientists by the name of Lou Gillette and his team found reproductive failure in alligators exposed to high levels of that pesticide from a spill in the lake. So it turned out that scientists learned that chemicals can act as anti-androgens and as estrogen, which means anti-androgen just means it blocks testosterone and male hormones. Scientists felt so strongly about this by 1991 that they issued a statement called the Wingspread Statement, where they talked about how chemicals in the environment can affect the hormones and then the reproduction of animals and perhaps humans. And it wasn't just alligators. Polar bears and in Svalbard in Norway have low testosterone. There's a missing generation of breeding bears, and all that might be, it seems like it's from the effects of PCBs, which is what they call an endocrine disruptor. An endocrine disruptor is sort of a broad term for chemicals that mimic hormones. And hormones can be the sex hormones like estrogen and testosterone. They can also be thyroid hormones and also immune system. Also, fish downstream of sewage treatment plants are turning out half male, half female. There's male fish that are having egg proteins. Snails, fish-eating birds, toads and frogs, seals, all kinds of wildlife that are exposed to chemicals like DDT, PCBs, dioxins, some of the older ones, and then some of the newer ones like BPA, bisphenol A, brominated flame retardants, the herbicide atrazine, TBT, which used to be used in marine paints. In fact, phthalates, which are found in plastics and cosmetics, fragrances. All of these are endocrine disruptors. And that again means that it describes things that can act like hormones. And some of the effects found in animal studies and some human studies now, there's been some human studies, are breast cancer, fibroids, endometriosis, early puberty, lactation issues, menopause changes, impaired fertility, reduced sperm counts, testicular abnormalities, miscarriages. And then there's the concern, like I said, about with DES, the multiple generation effects. In other words, what your grandmother is exposed to could affect the grandkids' reproduction later in life, because it switches genes on and off, and that's a permanent thing for multiple generations. So these chemicals could be having reproductive effects for multiple generations down the road. And of course, that leads to, you know, it could lead to ecosystem collapse and reproductive failure in wildlife, and it can affect longer time to pregnancy and infertility in human couples. And the very important lesson of that drug DES was that exposure before birth can lead to changes that show up in adolescence or adulthood. So you can just tell from that you're talking about things that are happening decades after that fetal exposure. So it's a very hard thing for scientists to study. And many of these chemicals are what they call weak endocrine disruptors or weak estrogens. They're not as strong as natural estrogen, not as strong as DES. So it's very hard to tell what the effects are of some of these compounds. I just wanted to mention a few the human studies that have occurred, if you're interested in looking at the human effects of chemical exposure and the effects on reproduction. There are studies out of UC Berkeley with a group of women based in the Salinas Valley, which is an agricultural area in central California. And also, they're looking at pesticides and consumer products. They found delayed time to pregnancy related to some chemicals. In 2006, there was a study out of Harvard University by a scientist, led by a scientist named Russ Hauser. He found an association between poor sperm quality and phthalates. And those are those chemicals that are found in fragrances and also in vinyl plastics. The rubber ducky chemical, if any of you have heard about that one. March 2010, there's a new study out of Italy with some U.S. researchers about there was an explosion that caused a big dioxin exposure in a little town in Italy, and they found that with high concentrations of those dioxins in people, they found increases in infertility in men. That Salinas study that I mentioned was done in 2008, and it found longer time to pregnancy associated with exposure to DDT. This was largely a Mexican-American population. Some of them were exposed to DDT in Mexico, and DDT was used in Mexico until 1990, I think, and U.S. 1972. So some of these are old legacy chemicals, but some of them are very new, like the phthalates. Then there was a study in 2010, an unusual study, another one with phthalates association. They think that phthalates can block androgen, block testosterone, and it was associated with minor alterations in testosterone in men. And also, this is an interesting one, reduced masculine play in boys. They found what they called less typical male behavior in the boys who had that fetal exposure to phthalates. And then, perhaps the biggest study, the landmark study done in 2006, which looked at baby boys exposed to phthalates, and they found signs of feminization of the genitals. It's called reduced anogenital distance, and you don't have to remember that phrase, but it just means feminized boys' parts is basically what it is. When you're exposed to too much estrogen in the womb or block the testosterone, then you're going to find out, you're going to find feminized offspring. At least that's what the animal studies show, and now some of these human studies. And then there was a really good review out of Tulane University in 2006, which had an overview of endocrine disruption and female reproductive health. I recommend that one. So from here, I would like Tracy Woodruff, as Director of the Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment at UC San Francisco. I'd like you, Tracy, to talk about some of the latest findings and why it is so difficult to prove in human populations whether these endocrine disruptors are having reproductive effects.
All right, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Actually, let's start with a little quiz because I thought maybe it would illustrate one of the studies that I'm going to talk about right now, which just came out this year. How many people know a child with cancer? And I'm going to raise my hand. Okay, keep your hands up. How many people know a child with ADHD or asthma? Right? See, so we're all raising our hand because there's many kids now who have some of these chronic conditions, asthma, neurodevelopmental effects such as ADHD or autism, childhood cancer. Each one of those have been going up in the population over the last 10 to 20 years. And now it's kind of a thing where people anecdotally might say, oh gosh, it seems like more kids, my kids, I'm a parent, have whatever these conditions are compared to when I was a child. And now the data say, yes, that is true. And there's a very interesting study that came out in 2010 on puberty. So, you know, I was talking to one of my friends, like, oh, my daughter went through puberty. She seemed like she was a little younger. And, oh, don't girls seem like they're kind of maturing a little more early than they used to be? Well, there was a study that came out this year that said, yes, girls are entering puberty earlier, and that sometimes they're as young as 7 years old. So my daughter's seven. That's second grade. Wow. That they're starting to notice changes in their breast development. So the study said, and it varies by race, so about 10% of Caucasian girls, I think it's like somewhere between 30 and 40 of African American girls, and then about 36% of Hispanics. That's all like 1 in 10 up to 150%. The study was published in Pediatrics. The first author is Biro. It was published this year. And what they also said, which was interesting, was that this anecdotal feature, like, oh, okay, we all know somebody who has one of these chronic conditions and it's different than it used to be, they confirm that for puberty. So that the rate of puberty has the entry into the age of puberty has declined over the last 10 to 30 years. So girls are entering puberty at a younger age. So these Caucasian girls, which was about 10% of them at age 7, were starting to have some type of change in their breast. It's double what it was about 10 to 30 years ago. So that's just that is an example of one of the studies that has come out that has been able to show these trends in time, which is leading to a lot of the concern we have about environmental chemicals, because the same one thing that has also changed over the last, say, 50 years is the number of chemicals that we have that we're using or that are around us in the environment. So it's been about a 20-fold increase in the amount of manufactured chemicals in the United States since the 1950s. And there's, if everyone has a copy of this, there's a graph in here. It's also been published in the peer-reviewed literature, which this is available online. It's called Shaping Our Legacy. It's right in here. And we have copies in Spanish, too, online, so shows that change. And one of the other things, so there's this thing where it's like, oh, wow, more kids have chronic conditions. So that's like, and oh, more chemicals are going up. Well, the other thing that's been changing, which is started with this wildlife issue, is our ability to find chemicals in people's bodies. So, and where did they come from? So, is anyone staying at the DoubleTree? Yeah, I'm staying at the DoubleTree. It's a really nice hotel. Just as I said, it has like you can open the window, which I always love in a hotel. And I look at the river, so I'm really extra happy here. This Neutrogena. And, you know, I was like, I like looking through what they offer because, okay, when you work in this field, you get totally paranoid and bring your own products everywhere, but you don't have to. But I was looking at this Neutrogena product because I was like, oh, when I go to the hotels, I look and see what's on the counter because it might be kind of interesting. And then I said, well, I know that a lot of these personal care products, which we now know, have chemicals in them. Well, you can't tell because they don't have to tell you what's on here, I guess, in the hotel. But it turns out that a lot of the chemicals that are in these personal care products are actually ending up in our bodies. So like the phthalates, a lot of reason we know about these phthalates is because people people, not the government people, but actually environmental group people, looked at the data that said, oh, we're finding phthalates in people's bodies, where does it come from? And they said, oh, well, look at this, these personal care products. And then it turns out that groups have gone, and you can actually go online. Oh, that's my other handout. So I have, like, cue cards for myself. About different ways that you can find out, for example, some of the chemicals that are in your personal care product. And in this personal care product, there's a chemical called parabens. And actually, it probably sounds like it's for candles. But nonetheless, there's these chemicals called parabens. And if we go to the CDC data, who measure all the many different chemicals in people's body, it turns out that like almost everybody in the United States has this chemical in their body, this parabens. So what we're finding is that we can measure the chemicals in the body. We know they're coming from things around us that are coming into our house. And it's not just one of these chemicals. It's many of these new and what people in environmental health science say are contemporary chemicals, because I used to work at EPA, so we didn't really study these chemicals before, and now we do, even though they've been around for many, many years. So the other part of this is that, we have these chronic conditions. Oh, there's a lot more chemicals. Ooh, we're finding them all in people, and it's not just one chemical at a time. So if you find the parabens, you still also have these PCBs, the polychlorinated biphenyls, are found in, you know, up to 100% of people in the U.S. Phthalates, 90 to 80% of people, more than 90% of people have bisphenol A. And I can name many other chemicals. So if you start to name them, you say, oh, well, that means everybody has at least probably a minimum of 8 and probably up to 50, 40. And actually, we're going to be publishing a study, which is under review, which looks at these chemicals, the number of chemicals in pregnant women. And we're going to show that we can find many different chemicals all at the same time in pregnant women, which is leading us to be concerned about, well, when we look at these science studies, both the data in animals and humans, what does that mean in terms of how chemicals can contribute to reproductive, in this case, reproductive health outcomes?
I think some studies actually show up to 200 chemicals.
Yes.
I know in the Arctic, where a lot of these chemicals migrate to, there's about 200 compounds found in people. Just testing
right.
their blood and their urine.
Right. And part of the challenge is that it's a little bit like we're limited by our technology, so the more you test, the more you find is what's really happening. So when CDC released their first report in 2000 looking at a little bit over 100 chemicals, they found, you know, some people had many, many of these chemicals. But as they added more, they find more. So, and there's over 80,000 chemicals that are registered for use in the United States. So you can imagine that it could be more and more as we sort of add things into the mix. So, and the second part of your question was science. How do we interpret science?
Why is it so difficult to prove in a human population?
To me the question is, well, you have a study, so people go out. So here's how we know about environmental chemicals and how they might impact health. People, or if you're at EPA, for example, I used to be at EPA, and you have data on animals. So they go, they expose the animals to some kind of chemical, and then they look and they count, oh, how many got birth defects, or how many got cancer, or whatever, and then they look and try to see if there's a relationship. So that's a good way to evaluate this without exposing people. Okay, I know there's issues about the animals, but in the hierarchy, it's better, in my opinion, than for people. So we use that to interpret. If we see something that causes an effect in animal, we assume that that will also have some type of increased risk in human. So I think that's one thing that, but there's not very many of those studies. So that's why it's hard to like figure out about all these chemicals, because we actually don't have enough studies about all these different chemicals. So that's why only a handful of chemicals have really been classified as carcinogenic or reproductive or developmental toxin, is because we've only studied a fraction of them. But some people are like, well, I want to see, it's very crude, but I really want to see what happens if we look in humans. I mean, you could see the whole ethical implications of that just generally. But be as it may, we're already performing kind of a natural experiment on ourselves, because we're already all exposed to these chemicals. And so our current approach is to go out and study, okay, what are people exposed to? And then if people have more of this chemical in their body, chemical A or whatever, do they have an increased risk of time to pregnancies? Take them longer to get pregnant? Do they have an increased risk of a birth defect? Something like that. The challenge with doing these studies in humans are many, many fold, which is, one, some of the risks, I mean, when we talk about an increased risk, it's not very high necessarily for environmental chemicals because they can act very subtly. So maybe, for example, air pollution. We've done a lot of work on air pollution, and we know air pollution can increase your risk of mortality. But the amount it increases your risk of dying is like 6%. So it's like 6 in 100 people. So if you only studied 100 people, it'd be kind of hard to see it because sometimes, you know, depending if I'm healthy, I might not be affected. If you don't have very many, if everyone is healthy in your population, maybe you only see two. Or, you know, it's hard to study so you need to study more people. So that means, like, maybe if I study 1,000 people and the risk is 6%, then I have a better chance of seeing it. Well, it's really expensive to study lots and lots of people unless it's air pollution because of the way they do it. So one challenge is that many of the studies, like the time to pregnancy study that you mentioned or the phthalate study in the male reproductive clinic, they really don't have very many people in their study, so it's hard to see the relationship. The challenge is that the relationship is really actually, so you're like, oh, well, it's only 6%, and I'm just one person, and my odds are pretty good. But everybody in the United States is exposed to these chemicals. So 6% among 360 million people, that's a lot of people. I don't even know how many is that. That's like 60,000 people or something like that. But I didn't know if I added that right. But you see that when we're doing the studies, we are very limited by the resources in terms of how many people we can study, even though we know that many, many different people are exposed. That's just one challenge. The other challenge is it's really hard to assess what people are exposed to. So if I say to you, hey, what'd you eat yesterday? What did I eat yesterday? I was on an airplane, and I had this yogurt. I mean, it's, you know, you have to, like, think about what did I eat and what did I do, and not everyone remembers that, right? So a lot of studies are like, well, I went and asked people what they ate yesterday, and then I try and figure out, well, what did they eat and what was chemicals were in those, and then you can see there's all this kind of, like, maybe some people remembered it correctly, maybe some people didn't.
And then if you're talking about a fetus, I mean, you're talking about decades before some kind
that makes it even
reproductive
harder.
Problem occurs.
Right.
You were trying to see what they were exposed to as a fetus.
Right.
So if you don't have cord blood or something like that, then, or what the pregnant mother was exposed to, then you don't have much of a study.
Right. So I think it makes it all, and which is why when we look at public health, we really like to go back to the animal studies because it's easier and it's you can control a lot of the experimental situation in order to try and really see if you have something that you need to be concerned about in terms of exposure to some of the environmental chemicals.
Erin is executive director of Women's Voices for the Earth and based in Montana. Is it Missoula?
Yeah, we're right here.
Right here in Missoula. And Erin, I'd like you to talk about
whatever you are, grizzlies.
talked about the consumer's role in sort of protecting themselves, especially in the absence of government regulation, because a lot of these chemicals are in consumer products and there's very little regulation, especially of things like cosmetics and fragrances. So what are consumers' roles and specifically women's roles in this?
Yeah, well, so the name of our organization is Women's Voices for the Earth. Obviously, we're focused on the particular health impacts that women face from toxic chemical exposure. And Tracy and Marla have both hit on a number of the studies out there that look at this data that relates some of these toxic chemicals and the health impacts that women might face. And I think that when we're looking at environmental decision making, women play a really unique role in this. Typically, women haven't necessarily been at policy making tables. If you look at Congress, women still only make up not even a quarter of members of Congress. But they've played a really unique role in shifting the marketplace and driving the driving policies that do end up being fought out in Congress. And one of the reasons that this is that women have unique social roles. So women right now make the majority of the healthcare decisions for their families. They make healthcare decisions in 3 out of 4 U.S. households. They're the primary caretakers in their family. And women make about 80% of the purchasing decisions in the United States. So if, you know, you can imagine that that means women often are more aware of health problems that their family face and that might be linked to environmental pollution. I'm going to give you an example. If you're a woman that has a child with asthma, for example, you're probably going to take a lot more note of the fact that maybe you have a polluting facility in your neighborhood. You're going to pay attention to that, and you're going to think that there's a causal link there. You're also going to pay attention to what you're buying and bringing into your home. If you know your child has asthma, you're going to look out for products that you bring in that might have chemicals in them that would trigger an asthma attack. So these are, I think, the links that there's a strong link for women that women make between the environment and human health. And I think that can be a really powerful place for pushing environmental policy. So women have played this unique role in the consumer marketplace, and over the last couple of years, we've really seen a lot of that. Recently, actually just in September, a report came out from this organization called Eco something. half my printing didn't come out, apparently. So the name of the report is Are You Ready for Eco-Aware Mom? It's EcoWorld. That's what the name of the organization is. And the eco-aware, they basically found that there's this eco-aware moms marketplace out there where parents are really finding, they want to make good choices. They want to be good examples for their children. They want to show them that, that you know, by making good choices, you can leave a good environmental legacy. And the market, this market includes more than 51 million women. 69% of those women are moms. And they have almost $1.5 trillion in buying power. So this is a huge sector, and you can see when you look out there all those green products. Now, there's a lot of question around how green are those green products, and that's a whole other dialogue. But there is a shift. Companies are starting to realize that this is an important market, and if there's consumer demand for green, healthier products, they're going to produce them. I want to give you an example of a couple of campaigns that we've seen over the last couple of years that have really driven this. Bisphenol A, this is one of those endocrine-disrupting chemicals that we've heard about. You've probably heard a lot of news about BPA. It's been in the news quite a bit lately. And this year, the FDA actually ruled that they didn't have enough information to really take action on BPA, to say, okay, we're not going to allow BPA in products in the market anymore. But regardless of that, environmental health groups and consumers and advocates said, you know, we're really concerned about BPA and our products. And because that happened, a particular example was a report was released looking at major brand name baby bottles, and these baby bottles had BPA in them. Well, if you're a mom, you're going to be a little freaked out when you find out that you've been feeding your newborn child with, you know, BPA in the baby bottle. So consumer pressure really resulted in major retailers pulling those bottles from their shelves. They pulled Avent, they pulled Gerber, they pulled major brands of baby bottles off the shelves. And then those manufacturers started reformulating their bottles and said, okay, I guess we're going to make them without BPA. REI pulled Nalgene bottles off the shelves. Nalgene bottles no longer have BPA in them. And when that happened, we started to see the ripple effect. Camelback, they don't have BPA anymore. All sorts of products you can see taking the chemical of concern out simply because the consumer marketplace demanded it. There's still legislation pending on BPA that's not really going anywhere right now, but these shifts are happening because consumers are demanding it. Another example is a campaign that was waged in 2007 to get toxic chemicals out of nail polish. It was waged against one major nail polish manufacturer, OPI. The Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, a huge group of women who are pretty angry that there's toxic chemicals in their makeup, gotten together and said, okay, why the heck are there these toxic chemicals in our nail polish? This is ridiculous. This is particularly bad for the nail salon workers who are putting nail polish on and breathing these chemicals in constantly. So consumers said, we want the toxic trio, as we dubbed it, toluene, dibutyl phthalate, and formaldehyde, yes, formaldehyde, out of these nail polishes. And it got to the point where women sent in thousands of postcards and, in fact, culminated in a protest at the headquarters of OPI in Los Angeles, dressed up in, you know, as beauty queens, sort of playing off the company's brand name, wearing badges, mistreatment, and, you know, got the company to say, okay, we'll take these chemicals out of our nail polish because consumers don't want it anymore. So that was incredibly powerful.
There's another one in nail polish, too. The phthalates used to be found in most nail polishes, and now it's gone. That's the one that was anti-androgen, a male hormone blocker.
Yeah, and Tracy had referred to that CDC study,
right,
where women, chemicals were tested in bodies, and 10 of the 116 chemicals that were found in women's bodies were phthalates. And phthalates are found in, you know, these products here, all lotions, all sorts of your products that you use. So there's a real correlation there of, well, why are women being more exposed to these sorts of chemicals?
Yeah, and that actually, there's another interesting piece of that story, too, is because, so the phthalates were included in that first report, and it turns out that CDC was not actually looking for the phthalates at the time. They were trying to do measurements of polychlorinated biphenyls. So they were going, and actually, if you talk to the chemist there, they were looking at polychlorinated biphenyls, and they kept getting this spike on their mass spectrometer, and they're like, whoa, what is this thing here? And they'd be like, oh, well, and they're all looking around, oh, well, that's phthalates. And they're like, well, why do you think there are phthalates? And they're like, oh, I don't know, maybe it's a contaminant from the needle. And I was like, I don't think this is a contaminant from the needle stick. And then they went and they looked a little closer, and they're like, oh, actually, the reason we have phthalates contaminating our PCBs is because all these people have phthalates in their bodies. So then CDC said, oh, well, maybe we should actually put this in our report. So, I mean, the thing that's so interesting about that story is that they were like, they didn't actually go to say, oh, maybe we should look for phthalates. It was like this accidental kind of finding that had many, many different, had a lot of downstream effects. But it just also speaks to what other accidental things are in the mix that we're not looking for. So when they came out with that report, Ben Blount published a study in Environmental Health Perspectives before the report came out on the phthalates. And what was interesting was one or two of the phthalates were higher in women of reproductive age than everybody else. And everyone was like, well, the government did nothing. So, but then the environmental group said, well, that's kind of weird. Where is it coming from? And so everyone just like, I don't know. And that's when environmental group said, well, what is it that women do more of that nobody else does? And they paint their nails and put on personal care products, and that led them to actually test the personal care products, like Not So Pretty had nail polish, perfume, underarm deodorant, and that then led to this campaign. But it was
part of the problem is that they're not on an ingredient list, so you look at your
says
cosmetic product, it says perfume or fragrance or something like that. It's not going to say phthalates.
Mm-hmm.
It's not required on ingredient list.
Right, because it's part of the, fall through that loophole. So it's a very interesting interaction between science and consumer activism in that way.
Because certainly the BPA baby bottle one, it was not brought on by any regulatory effort anywhere. It was purely driven by women with babies.
Right.
And that's pretty amazing because they acted a lot faster against industry than regulation ever would have.
Right. Just another example going back to that is actually a campaign that we did locally here, just to simply ask Albertson's stores, a supermarket chain, to post mercury and fish advisory warnings on their fish counters, because mercury is a really potent neurotoxin for developing fetuses. So if you're a pregnant woman or trying to get pregnant or a breastfeeding woman, you really don't want to eat a lot of fish contaminated with mercury. And a lot of women aren't aware of that. So we wanted to just have at least signs at a fish counter so when you're there, you could know which choices were low in mercury. And Albertsons didn't want to do that. They didn't want to, you know, put out this information and scare consumers away from buying fish. So after dialogue, you know, numerous phone calls, lots of dialogue, hundreds of postcards, they weren't doing much. And then all it took was two simultaneous protests, one at the store here in Missoula, one at their headquarters in Boise, Idaho, of women with their babies and their strollers showing up saying, hey, we just want a warning sign. We're not really even asking for much here. And they agreed, and we worked with them to develop the sign that they then post on their stores, 1,000 stores nationwide. So it's a pretty incredible, I think, constituency to engage, because women as consumers can be really powerful.
Well, certainly women with babies and women with strollers and pregnant women is a much more powerful source than the law we have in the United States that regulates chemicals. It's called the Toxic Substances Control Act. It was written in 1976, and it's very much outdated. Most people seem to agree on that. There's just very little that EPA has power to do. The last chemical, and all these chemicals we're talking about, we were thinking, well, why doesn't EPA just ban it? Well, the last chemical that EPA banned was asbestos in 1989, and it was thrown out of court because there wasn't enough evidence under the law.
Yeah.
And that was a very well-documented carcinogen. So if they can't ban asbestos, they're certainly not to the point where they can ban BPA or phthalates, although they're looking at those types of chemicals. More regulation, not bans, but more regulation.
Yeah, so under current law, about 62,000 chemicals that are in use have been grandfathered in as safe. So we just assume these chemicals are safe because they were already in use when the law was passed. And now we have lots of science that says, whoa, maybe that's not the case. Time to kind of revisit this. And we're seeing a huge fight to actually get that a new updated law passed.
And there's division of authority, too. Like FDA controls cosmetics. EPA doesn't. So, and FDA has been very slow in dealing with any kind of chemicals in consumer products.
Yeah, well, their regulatory authority is, they have no real, it's all voluntary, so they don't have any real regulatory authority on cosmetics. It's part of the challenge.
And that's another law that has been introduced is the Safe Cosmetics Act that would actually work to give FDA the authority that they need to regulate these chemicals that are going into personal care products.
A question related to this?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. I can fold this in.
I am particularly concerned with the next invisible wave of chemicals, which are we under it right now, which is the water. For the most part, the water throughout the world is not being filtered for pharmaceuticals and hormones. And in Congress, it has been said out of the 90,000 chemicals that we have right now, only 5 are regulated by EPA, and all of them are going straight into
Yeah, there's very little monitoring of drinking water for pharmaceuticals and for estrogens. I mean, how estrogens are getting into the water supply is largely from birth control pills, not compounds.
Right. I mean, there is a contribution from birth control pills. Actually, we just have a review that's coming out, Environmental Science and Technology, on oral contraceptives. And first of all, people excrete natural estrogens themselves. So, and if you're pregnant, you excrete a lot of estrogen. So there's a natural component of estrogens, and oral contraceptives is one part of that. There's a lot of estrogenic compounds that are synthetic and natural that come from agriculture. Agriculture is a very large source of estrogenic compounds that we have. So if you go to the bathroom, which I'm pretty sure all of you will do today, and it goes down into the sewer, it goes right to the water treatment plant. If a cow goes to the bathroom, it goes right on the ground and then can be leached into the water. So there's actually two tiers. And then once it goes to the water treatment plant, it goes and then it's treated, it's released back out, and then goes and gets treated again before it goes to your drinking water. So there is pretty, depending on where you live, can be and the kind of technology you have, a pretty good recapture for human sewage for some of these estrogenic compounds. For the cows and the chickens and the pigs, it just goes right in, doesn't go through a sewage treatment plant, may be recaptured out of the drinking water plant. So, and then lastly, there are industrial compounds. So one of these compounds, nonylphenol, for example, which is used in detergent and things like that, found in many different drinking water supplies. It's not as potent as your oral contraceptives, but it's found in much higher concentrations. So I think you're right. The drinking water issue is a big problem. The way the law is set up, we can't the monitoring, it's not like air pollution where we have a great law for monitoring air pollution. We have a not very good law for monitoring water pollution. There are about 80 contaminants on the drinking water list that EPA regulates, has a drinking water standard. So, and there are many more that are on the docket to go into a regulatory authority. But
I think there's some pilot programs for looking at pharmaceuticals. And
yes, there are some pharmaceuticals on the CCL list, the criteria contaminant list. Is that right, Jen Seth? I'm looking at you, right? Is there a few pharmaceuticals on that list? Yeah, I think so. But, I mean, that's slow.
We'll go to more questions, but I just want to make one point that we're talking here mostly about reproductive effects, which can affect fertility or cause reproductive cancers, but there's a whole host of other issues, and one of them is in this story here, the developmental effects. When a pregnant woman is exposed, a fetus is exposed, you can have IQ effects, neurological effects, which aren't related to reproductive effects, but they're similar, they're developmental effects. So there's a packet of three different stories I included there. Okay, let's go to questions.
In that list, I didn't hear any mention of sexuality, and I'm wondering, when you talk about anogenital distance and we talk about feminization or Tyrone Hayes's work with atrazine and homosexual frauds or homosexual behaviors, who's finding frauds, and wasn't the DES some research on lesbianism in daughters of DES mothers?
I hadn't heard that.
I'm just curious. I mean, for me, the next question is, if we are seeing these effects, or, you know, kind of less aggressive play in baby boys, I know that that's a dangerous can of worms to get into, but I wonder what your thoughts are about sexuality. If we're talking about feminization, could there also be a certain feminization going on in the brain or in our sexual orientation in the population? I'm just curious what your thoughts are about it. It's kind of this brand new world.
Yeah.
Definitely a touch of
I know, really. Like, give me the hard question. That's really hard.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when the endocrine disruption stuff was coming out in the 90s, and there was a rash of stories in the media about it. In 2020, did this sort of bizarre thing of showing a transsexual walking on the beach. And that just, I mean, I couldn't believe it at the time. It was like, well, I mean, we're talking about very little knowledge about what these hormone effects, and that's what they made this huge leap. And so we're a little closer to that leap, but I still don't think there's any research to back up.
No, well, I'm not that familiar with the, I mean, I'm familiar with the feminization issues in terms of the
Reproductive track.
Right, the reproductive track. I think the important point is that with the BPA and the child play is that animal studies had already shown, and actually NTP said this, that there's concern about the effects of BPA on the developing brain. And this is just one aspect of brain development that this particular researcher happened to look at, but that's not the only aspect of brain development that may be affected. I think the issues about sexuality and feminization and what that means is, you know, something that I think is not, part of that is a scientific discussion, but part of it is a society discussion, right? So, I mean, I think what the research is saying is that you have these chemicals and you get exposed during pregnancy, and it can change the organization of your brain in some way, and it can manifest in many different ways, so.
Kind of branching off your comments about the cattle, could you maybe go over, I seem to recall hearing there were some studies coming out about food supply and what kind of pharmaceuticals and things were ending up in that now, and if there was proof that that they were able to transfer from soil into, say, corn as it's growing. But I wasn't sure if that was something on your radar, and it occurred to me because you were talking about, you know, cattle waste
right.
going off in drinking water. When really with the, it strikes me out here, the way most of it is going with the larger farms and everything is they're piling it all up and they're using it as nutrients for crops because there's these stringent regulations about runoff now. And that's where most of it is getting concentrated, is in the soils and in the crop.
Right. I should have qualified that there's both the runoff that comes from when the animal, you know, goes to the bathroom, and then there's also when you take the fertilizer, whatever, the waste, and put it on to plants where it then can, you know, there's runoff from agriculture too. So, and I don't know, I'm not that familiar with the what's taken up from the waste stream into the plants that actually goes onto the table. I mean, I know there's some studies that have shown, for example, perchlorate, which is a thyroid disrupting chemical, for example, everybody has perchlorate in their body, but it's really only in a few places. It's in the water supply in the Colorado River, and because it goes on to the into the agriculture and is taken up by the lettuce.
It's related to the defense industry. It's a rocket fuel. Perchlorate.
And in firecrackers.
Yeah, in firecrackers. Well, I think there's less of a risk in the food supply with many of these contaminants unless they do what's called bioaccumulate, which is move up the food chain. A lot of these pharmaceuticals, they're sort of flushed out of the body, whereas things like PBDEs, the flame retardants, they'll accumulate and build up in your body, and that means they're building up in the food chain.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, it's variable depending on the chemical.
USGS is a great source for endocrine disruption.
Are you guys still
looked at rivers and streams? And
are you still? Is that monitoring continuing? Because I heard it had been like defunded.
It's still continuing, and you're probably thinking about the water level.
Yeah. So one of them was defunded, but one of them is.
Some of our stream gauges have been defunded.
I see. Do in India for our chemicals.
You want to talk about the precautionary principle, or should I?
Well, in Europe, they have the European Union adopted REACH. Okay, regulatory. You know what it stands for?
I can't remember.
No.
REACH. Evaluation, authorization, chemical hazards. Or maybe you know what REACH stands for. I can't remember what it's called, but it's a law that requires that everybody to stay on the market has to submit certain pieces toxicity information on their chemicals in order to be used in the marketplace. The toxicity battery, which means all the tests that they use, is not. I mean, it's a simple set of tests. It's not considered completely robust. So there's some question about what, you know, what'll be happening. Though they have declared a number of different chemicals as, I think, hazardous. Is that right? On their list. Is that right? They, I can't remember what they call their list. They're like high concern list.
Probably yeah, they're very hazardous.
Right. And they do have a list of chemicals on that. It's, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen. Well, they have to go through some of the, they have to be phased out, or they have to prove that the use will not, you know, it's very special and it won't, no one will get any exposure and there won't be any risks. So it's something to that effect.
I don't think it translates into labeling.
No, there's no labeling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's still a huge lack of disclosure overall around chemical use, particularly in the U.S. We really have no laws that give consumers information about what chemicals are in use. And we did identify one area of fragrances. So a fragrance can be made up of like up to 100 different chemical ingredients, one of those which is often phthalates. So we're really concerned about those sort of hidden ingredients that make up fragrance. And that's an area where we see huge battles because that information is considered proprietary, even though we're seeing health impacts from just very small doses of these chemicals that are included in fragrances. So we have a lot of work on the regulatory side to open up that loophole.
And California has new rules going into effect early next year, I think, which requires a clearinghouse for consumers to look at chemical ingredients and potential effects, and then also to look at the most hazardous chemicals and try to get them out of consumer products. It's sort of a mini REACH in California. It's just starting to go into force now.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question. It's maybe slightly tangential to what we're talking about, but when I hear reproductive health, I think about the explosion in both breast cancer and prostate cancer, certainly in discussion, the public discussion about these two epidemics is all in terms of a cure. And so I wonder, you know, we talked about lack of resources for studying. There's not a lack of resources, maybe we can talk about a little bit about that.
That's kind of, you know, when you get the New York Times magazine, you open it up, and there's this person, and there's like, I defeated cancer. It's like, oh, but you got cancer, right? I mean, that's like, I don't know. It's like, and what if you're like a loser? You don't defeat cancer? I guess that, I don't know. I just, everything about that is like, bugs me. Sorry, that was an aside, but it's like a fight or a bad.
I mean, a preventer, not a survivor.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But no one has an ad that says, oh, I didn't get cancer. You know what I mean? Okay, but that's. But it's true. There's this let me actually go back to your first question, which is reproductive health is, for us anyway, is really over the life course. It's not only your ability to conceive, but your ability to have a healthy pregnancy and then a healthy childhood and then a healthy reproductive capacity, but a healthy adulthood. Because, as Marla was saying, the exposures that occur early on can have influences over your whole life. So certainly cancers and reproductive cancers like prostate and breast cancer are part of that, and we've, like you said, seen increases in that as well as testicular cancers in the population over the last 20 years. So maybe you want to answer the question about why we don't have prevention, because it's really a public policy, where's the money type thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly as you were saying. There's not a lot of public will to focus on prevention. And one of the things that, you know, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so you're probably seeing pink ribbons everywhere. And what's so disturbing about that is all of these companies that are producing products, putting chemicals in these products that are linked to breast cancer, are putting a happy little pink ribbon on their product and donating to the cure, when instead they should just be taking the chemicals out and contributing to the prevention. So we don't have that message is not getting out broadly enough. Nobody's asking hard enough, well, where is this coming from? Why are we getting breast cancer? And that's it's simply just a matter of, I think, changing the public dialogue and asking that question more and holding these companies accountable. There's, I mean, KFC, the Kentucky Fried Chicken, for God's sake, has this program right now where, you know, they were donating to Susan B. Komen for the cure if you buy this giant bucket of chicken that's got a chemical that was directly linked to breast cancer. So those types of things are just ridiculous, and those cancer research organizations as well should not be taking money and doing promotional deals with companies that are contributing to the causes of breast cancer in the first place. So I think, you know, we have a lot of embedded corporate interests still that are influencing policies in this country and influencing the public dialogue too. And I would just sort of implore everyone to get the message out and ask that question every time you're reporting about breast cancer: where is it coming from anyway? Because we just, you know, we have to ask that.
And I'll say, you know, the financial incentive obviously in the industry is on the cure, because that's, somebody makes money from giving
right.
a cure. Nobody
right.
makes money in the healthcare industry from spending more time with their patient talking about advice or going and, you know, doing something that's prevention-oriented. There's both the personal advice, but then there's the public policy, and the public policies are not set up for prevention right now. So
I also think that there's sort of a lack of knowledge among many doctors and many health mm-hmm. professionals. They'll tell, you know, somebody, well, you won't get lung cancer if you don't smoke cigarettes. And there's so many other causes of these types of cancers, which they're sort of afraid to tell people about because they don't want to be alarmist or whatever. I mean, there was an example of this is, I wrote a story about a report by the President's Panel on Cancer, which said that environmentally caused cancers were grossly underestimated, and it was no longer the, 4% or whatever that EPA was saying, that it's much higher from things like industrial chemicals and pollutants and x-rays and that kind of thing. Well, the chief epidemiologist for the American Cancer Society got very upset by that and said that the report really should have stressed the classic cigarette smoking and those types of things, because those are the main causes of cancer. So here was a panel that was trying to bring attention to something that wasn't getting enough public awareness, and they were attacked by the American Cancer Society for not giving the same old mantra. I mean, it obviously has to be balanced. I mean, we know for sure that cigarette smoking causes heart disease and cancer, but there's also some pretty compelling evidence about some of these other things, and a lot of doctors and health professionals don't really want to address that at this point.
I want to follow up on that too, because that the president's cancer panel report, I think it's very. I would recommend people to read that because, first of all, the people appointed by that were appointed by President Bush. So this is not, some right left wing kooky. It was the Bush's president's cancer panel, first of all, and then second of all, it's sponsored by the National Cancer Institute. So this is a government appointed government document that has very important things to say about the role of environmental chemicals and cancer. And not only did they say we underestimate it, they also said that the public bears the burden of trying to decide what's going on with chemicals and cancer. And they also had many good statements, I thought, about the failures in the regulatory process to deal with chemicals and their interaction with cancer. So I think that report, it did get a lot of press, but it really deserves a lot more attention because it's very thoughtful.
Most of the press was about the controversy about whether, I think most epidemiologists who have done any environmental work at all would say, yes, it is grossly underestimated, the amount of cancers that are attributed to environmental causes. So there was really nothing wrong with that statement, but it just triggered all kinds of dispute in the cancer community.
Where can you find that report?
It's online. If you just Google President's Cancer Panel Report on Environmental Chemicals and the National Cancer Institute, they are required by law to sponsor a report on the state of cancer every year, and that year happened to be, it's the last one that came out, happened to be on environmental chemicals.
Another question?
So you talked about a lot of beauty products that aren't specifically labeling all the chemicals. Do you think that's important for those chemicals to be on there? Are consumers educated enough to really understand what those chemicals are and how they're affecting them? Would that put enough pressure on producers to take them out? Or is labeling just so kind of up in the air here in the U.S. that it wouldn't really matter?
I mean, my perspective is that consumers have the right to know what's in their products, and they also have a right to understand that information. That's where it gets tricky, but right now we're not even at the step where consumers have information to go look. There are there's one great resource called Skin Deep. This is a database where you can go, you can type in the products that you use, the personal care products that you use, and you'll get a rating, a scale of 0 to 10 that tells you how toxic your product is. Now, this is based on information that is reported on the product label. So personal care products, there are some ingredients listed, but there's sort of these black boxes like fragrance where it just says perfume or fragrance on there. Other categories of products, though, you don't see any labeling at all, like cleaning products. If you pick up your cleaning product bottle, there's no requirements right now that companies have to tell you what's in those products whatsoever. So I think consumers are getting more savvy. I think that people know certain things to avoid now. If you're paying attention to the news, you might say, okay, I want to avoid phthalates. Well, that's difficult because it's not listed on there anyway. But as a reaction to consumers wanting that information, companies that have taken phthalates out are putting no phthalates on their labels, no parabens. So they're sort of helping consumers figure that out too. And the problem is we ultimately simply, I think you just want to know that what you buy is safe and you don't really want to deal with it because people are busy and we have a lot going on in our lives. But at the same time, it's important to have that transparency from my perspective because we can never fully trust, that the decisions being made are, in fact, protective of public health. So if you do have the information, you can be a really avid consumer and do your own research if you're that type of consumer. Not everyone's going to do that, but you should have the option to do that if you want to.
Right, I think that's a really good point. But you shouldn't have to be a chemist to go to buy your consumer products. I mean, I look at the back of those things. I don't know what half that stuff is on the back. And the fact that I think people don't know that when they go to the store, they assume that when you go to the store and buy your Neutrogena that somebody has tested all the chemicals, and that's simply not the case. And so I think consumers are shopping under false pretenses.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think we need both.
Right. You should definitely tell everyone what's in it because it's
best.
Yeah.
question that occurs to me is why, for example, is BPA in the plastic that the baby bottles are made out of in the first place? In other words, we're dealing with the back end. Aren't these companies required, or don't they analyze chemicals that go into their products? And if so, then that's kind of a criminal conspiracy.
I think you've hit on it.
But they're not required to. So if you're a chemical manufacturer and you're like, oh, look at this cool chemical, it makes this plastic, and I go to the government and my requirements to manufacture something or to, I don't know, whatever they are, but, tell them that I have something and set up my corporation and blah, 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 there's no requirement to test the safety. You know, why should you? Because, there's operating in a sort of a bubble of unregulatory or not having no requirements, I guess, mm-hmm. is how I would say it. So it's not necessarily that the manufacturers themselves are knowingly making chemicals that are toxic. It's just that, well, their mindset is, I want to make a product. I want to make a good product that people will buy. I'm going to fulfill the regulatory requirements that I have before me. Safety is not one of them, so I'm not going to do that because I'm mindful of my profits that I'm trying to make. It's totally reasonable from a manufacturing standpoint. If you don't have to do something, why would you do it? But which is why we are concerned about having this sort of bar that says, well, one of the things we're going to require is that you use chemicals that are tested. And if you did that, then they would go through all the chemical lists that they have for picking things out to put in their products. They'd be like, well, I have to have this tested, and then if it doesn't meet the criteria, I can't use it. But they are as much blinded by this as we are. They have as little information as we do about some of these.
I'd like to add a little bit on that, because European Union the safety of the chemical before you can use it. That is putting tremendous pressure on U.S. chemical law, which hasn't changed in the last 30 years or more. So there are not right now two projects in Congress, one in the Senate, one in the representative, to change that. But the chemical industry in this country is amazingly strong, and it's not the whole potential.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that too. Is that right?
OPI.
Is OPIs? Is that right?
Right.
But are they still like two different product lines? One in the U.S. versus Europe?
No, because it's valid for a year.
Oh, that's right.
I think it was sold in Europe first.
Right.
It's starting to change. It's becoming more worldwide.
Right.
This is a horrible website, but that's the president's cancer
report. Oh, well, thank you.
That's like, okay.
Yes?
I'm going to be giving a talk here in this room tomorrow, Saturday. I kind of think it's 10:15 or whatever. It's a nanotechnology panel.
Oh,
and I'm going to be touching very quickly over the different statutory authorities, showing what exactly are the weaknesses is and why when you register a new chemical and get into commerce, why it falls through the cracks and where the cracks are, which I think is interesting, rather than just saying these chemical laws don't work. I'll be touching over the NFTA reach.
Great.
Question over there? Oh,
yeah,
Julie.
Sorry. You're talking a lot about reproductive infection chemicals that we are unknowingly exposed to. I'm curious if any of you know anything about the potential effects, or if there are any studies being done on the effects of fertility drugs.
The effects on what?
Fertility drugs and ovarian cancer. Well, there have been some studies on some of these fertility drugs and ovarian cancer. I think the results of they're tricky to do because you have to find someone who's independently funded because there's a lot of financial stake in those studies. I think the studies are mixed, though I did see something on Clomid and ovarian cancer, so it could possibility of some increased risk of ovarian cancer. There are also studies looking at IVF and what that might mean for increased risks of effects in the children. Again, also, some animal studies have done this work. There's some work that's been done at UCSF, as well as I believe Carmen Williams has done some of this work at she used to be at University of Pittsburgh, and she's now at NIEHS.
What's her name?
Carmen Williams. She's a good contact on this, actually, because she is an MD, PhD, and does a lot of...
Where is she now?
She's at NIEHS, National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences. So I would recommend her to... She knows... Also, Paolo Rinaldo, who's at UCSF, knows a lot about IVF and reproductive health outcomes.
We can probably take two more questions.
I'm sorry. I love your book on science notes.
Oh, I got to see that book. Can you hand me?
It's an open window the size of a complete building to see the horrendous plant and chemicals. What are you working on?
Well, I am, right now I'm editor-in-chief of Environmental Health News. I left the LA Times 2 years ago to start a foundation-funded journalism venture. Environmental Health News has aggregated the news for, like, since 2003 or 2002, but now we're doing our own journalism to sort of fill the void of newspapers that are going under and firing their environmental writers and that type of thing. So I've been focusing a lot on writing about endocrine disruptors because there's just very little press attention for things like this. The media has just been hit so hard. I know in California that most of the major newspapers have lost their most experienced environmental writers. And it takes quite a bit of experience to write about. You can see how technical some of these issues are, how difficult they are. And you don't want to be alarmist, but you don't want to underplay it either. And so I've been focusing on that. Doing that type of reporting, and I haven't assigned anybody to write about anything related to the Gulf oil spill, because that's where all the environmental reporters have been for the last few months. Mm-hmm. Whereas they're not writing about things like reproductive health. It just needs a lot more attention. Question?
I think one of the big game, there's sort of two areas of just general research that are big game changers now. One is on this the study of epigenetics and changes in gene expression and how chemicals can affect changes in gene expression. So everyone knows we have DNA and you know, the makeup control, all the things that go on in your body. But the way the DNA, a cell divides, the DNA is split apart, and they go into another cell, but the way that they do that and make the cells act is called epigenetics. It's sort of the difference between your computer, which is your hardware, your DNA, and then the software, which makes your computer do all that stuff, whatever the magic is that happens in there. That's like your epigenetics. So, in environmental health, a lot of the focus has been on how, when you like mess up your hard drive, what does that happen, to your health? But now we're looking at, chemicals can come. They don't necessarily change the sequence of your DNA or affect it, but they can change the way the DNA is talking or interacting, and that can have very important changes, can have also influences on health. And then that sort of relates to the other area, which is this, I think this area of prenatal exposures and early life exposures is really, and when you're in environmental health now, it seems so boring because we've been talking about it for so long, but it's still really a big deal, and it's very profound in terms of, it's not just, did I get a birth defect, but did I have these subtle effects that happen later, and do those manifest later? The childhood cancer, it was an excellent paper on pesticide exposures and leukemias, which I think is a very undercovered story in the news, and then also how it affects later to these metabolic disorders later in life, like diabetes, but also certainly cardiovascular disease. So those are sort of the two big areas. I think in terms of sort of game-changing articles, I mentioned one. I do think the phthalates and the anogenital distance is very important, and not necessarily, I think it's important because it shows this feminization issue, but I also think, to me, what's very critical about that study is that she first looked at the animal data. So this whole thing about anogenital distance, which, okay, I'm going to say it's the measure from the anus to the genitals, and the shorter it is, that means you're a boy. It's bigger, you're a girl. So, and they've been using this in animal toxicology for years to figure out the difference between boys and girls. They, like, pick up the rat. They're like, oh, girl, boy, based on looking at that marker. But no one had ever done this in humans, even though it was standard in animals. And so the innovative thing about that study was like, well, let's look in humans and see if we see the same thing. What it serves two things. One is, yes, it's becoming a standard marker. It's going to become a standard marker, I think, in humans. But also it means, reinforces that we should be paying attention to these animal studies, which I think, you know, the human studies are compelling, but if we're seeing it in animals, we should be concerned about for humans. And then in terms of areas that are sort of lacking, I think this idea about exposures, like what are all the chemicals and where are they and what is in our body, I think it's just a huge area of mystery. I mean, the reason we know about BPA and phthalates is almost accidental, and that's not really a very good way to do public health, in my opinion, and we should have a more, like, shouldn't we actually look at all the highest volume chemicals and then see where they show up in our products and then see where people are exposed? That would be a very logical way to do it, but it's not really how we do it. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in science to try and mirror. And actually, we're going to be trying to do some of that stuff at UCSF, is sort of more unbiased interrogation of biological samples to see what kind of things show up rather than just be like, well, let's go figure if something else is in there and looking in pregnant women's samples from pregnant women.
This website at the top was put together by Theo Colborn, who was one of the scientists who developed the endocrine disruption theory. And she has a very interesting website. It's a little technical, but you can go by a particular chemical and then look at the effects on the fetus from, you know, throughout its development. So it's called Critical Windows, and it's just a really excellent site. It might take a little practice to understand what it says, but it's full of information. I guess one more question, then we're going to go.
Maybe you should mention her book.
Our Stolen Future, which was Theo Colborn and my publisher, Pete Myers, and a couple other people published that book in 96?
Five?
Mm-hmm.
Seven?
Six? Mid-90s.
Isn't her website endocrinedisruptionexchange.com, I thought, because isn't endocrinedisruption somebody else?
This is what I picked up from it.
It said Theo Colborn on it. I'm sorry.
There's more of these handouts,
maybe
too, at the front.
There's two URLs, but I know she said when last time I talked to her, she said it's not in
the
construction.
That's the one I picked up this morning. And then again, cancer reports. So. All right, and if you want to know what the media has reported about these issues, reproductive issues, I handed out the cards for Environmental Health News, and we aggregate all the news, and so you can type in, you know, fertility and chemicals or whatever, and you'll find all the what the media has written over the past 8 years on those topics. So. Well, thank you, everybody. We're supposed to meet now.